is CoDiscovery. Hello, welcome to this episode of CoDiscovery with me, Abigail Acton. The objects we have around us tell us much about who we are, what we can manufacture, what's considered desirable, what we can afford, what we can produce and export, and our trade routes. The past is shadowy, but the objects that mattered to the societies that came before us illuminate those who produced and used them in the same way. So this episode, we're considering cloth, glass, and stone, and what they reveal about innovation and cultural connections in the Middle Ages. What can textile production in Romano-Byzantine Egypt tell us about that culture? Who wove what and how? Glass is a demanding medium, both technologically and logistically, and how it was used in Byzantine and Islamic cultures shines a light, pun fully intended, on their aesthetics and innovations. The way glass was used reveals cultural dynamics, as do the medieval headstones in the Western Balkans. What do these weathered stones tell us about how different cultures in this period lived alongside each other? Helping to piece together the puzzle of medieval socio-economic history are our three guests, whose work has been supported by the EU's Horizon 2020 programme. Nadine Chabil is Senior Research Scientist at the French National Centre for Scientific Research. Nadine is interested in the geopolitical, sociocultural and artistic dimensions of glass in the first millennium CE. Hello, Nadine.
Hello, everybody.
Maria Mosakowska-Gobert is a postdoc researcher at the University of Copenhagen. Her research focuses on the material culture of Egypt from the Ptolemaic to the early Arab period. Hello, Maria.
Hello, Abigail. Hello, everybody.
Sasha Chavel is a research fellow at the University of Reading, UK. Sasha's research incorporates archaeological and anthropological perspectives to study multicultural societies, whether in the medieval Western Balkans or the colonial and post-colonial Indian Ocean. Welcome, Sasha.
Thank you very much, Abigail. Thank you for having me.
Nadine, glass roots traces Mediterranean-wide development in the production, trade, and consumption of glass between the 7th and 12th centuries. So can I ask you, what makes glass such an interesting material in this period?
Well, glass is interesting because glass was a material that traveled and sometimes over very long distances. What I mean by that is that glass was produced in only a very few places, so the primary production of glass, and from there it was traded to all the corners of the Mediterranean. And by analyzing the glass, so the chemical composition of glass reflects the primary production location, so we can literally trace the movement of this material. Let me explain. I should probably say something about the material itself.
Please do.
So Roman and medieval, early medieval glass is a soda-lime silica glass, which means it's a mixture of a silica in the form of sand and a fluxing agent to bring down the melting temperature. The fluxing agent has changed over time, but the main fluxing agent throughout the Roman period and, well, the first millennium, in fact, was a mineral source of soda that was collected from salt lakes in northern Egypt. So this mixture of sand and soda was fused in large tank furnaces at a temperature of about 1,000 degrees centigrade. Now, not every sand source is suitable, and we need clean soda sources. So this restricts your possibilities as to where you can actually collect these raw materials. So as a result of this, these technical and material requirements, the production of glass from its raw materials was concentrated in very few locations on the Levantine coast, which is nowadays Palestine, Israel, and in northern Egypt. And as I said before, from there, it was then traded throughout the Mediterranean. Now, the production of glass was huge. I'm talking here about glass blocks that were formed in one sitting, so to speak, in the order of 10 to 30 tons.
Yes, that's absolutely fascinating because, you know, you see this beautiful glass and one appreciates, I think one sees it as sort of so delicate and small because the objects sometimes are quite small. I'm thinking of sort of beautiful domestic objects and so on. But the concept of such vast quantities being produced like that, that must have been so technologically advanced. It must have been a massive engineering feat.
Absolutely. So it is, glass can be considered one of the earliest synthetic man-made material that was produced on an industrial scale. For metallurgy, we have furnaces that reach temperatures in the same range, but it is quite demanding in many, many ways. And then these blocks of glass, or these huge massive blocks were broken up and then traded. Again, glass is relatively heavy. So we have shipwrecks that carried 2 to 3 tons of glass to Constantinople, for instance. It is a fascinating material.
And what sort of period would that sort of trade be taking place when you say shipwrecks and etc.? What sort of period?
That's a very good question. And again, a very fascinating thing about glass. We have shipwrecks with that had glass as the main cargo already during the late Bronze Age. This said, not quite in these amounts, but still already quite significant. Certainly during the Roman period, we have several shipwrecks. Many of them sunk off the southern coast of France, for instance. And still during the early Islamic period, this still is going on, the sort of large-scale production, and this separation between primary production and secondary production is still continues until late first millennium, possibly into the 11th century.
I see. Why so many off France? Is that because we've discovered them off France, or because the coast is treacherous?
Actually, that's I don't know, but there's certainly a lot of glass coming in into France. And Marseille, for instance, was an important port city during the Roman period.
Right. So it's actually proportionate to how much was actually coming in.
Exactly. And at the same time, I assume that many, many shipwrecks haven't been really discovered yet. So there's still plenty to explore archaeologically, I think.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. There may be more elsewhere as well. Indeed. And how did different cultures explore and use glass? What can that tell us about the interplay between them, the trade routes, for example, and other dynamics of exchange?
I think in order to really answer this question, we should probably go a step back and ask why glass in the first place, because we are seeing how difficult it is. So why go through all the trouble to produce glass? Now, I think part of the answer probably lies with the material and optical properties of glass, which were used and exploited for utilitarian as well as artistic purposes. So glass can be shaped almost infinitely. It offers a wide range of colors, many more and much more luminous than, for instance, natural stone. And glass can be transparent, translucent, or completely opaque. So it has a wide range of applications in a way. So, and as an example, I think the most obvious property of glass is probably its transparency, which ultimately inspired the use of glass for windows, so window glass, during the Roman period. The earliest example that we have dates to the first century. And it is often said that the invention of window glass was connected to the construction of the large Roman bathhouses, so the terme that we know from, for instance, in Rome. Now, these Roman glasses, window glasses, are usually not strongly colored. They are bluish or greenish, which is the result of the impurities of the sand source. And they are not entirely transparent like modern window glass, but more translucent. Now, the invention of strongly colored window glass belongs to the Middle Ages. And it's usually associated with ecclesiastical contexts in the Latin West. And this is this offers a remarkable some remarkable insights into the differences between cultures, because in the Byzantine Empire, the window glass tends to be only weakly colored. Here, however, we have strongly colored mosaic decorations. And in the Islamic world, we have both. We have strongly colored window glass and mosaics. So again, a very interesting dimension in terms of the artistic use of glass, and which is probably to a certain extent related to concepts of the divine and interaction of glass with light, so whether light is transmitted or whether it's reflected. So there are many, many different dimensions that feed into the use of glass.
So I have two questions that are coming to my mind. I'll continue with the question that feeds on from what you're saying, but then I've got a question that throws back to what you said something earlier. What innovations came about due to the aesthetic imperatives? In other words, if a certain culture really needed to make a certain type of mosaic, did they must have, I presume, have come up with methods of doing so?
I'm not sure whether you would call this innovation as such, but mosaics are quite fascinating because mosaics are considered a quintessential Byzantine art form, even if they are found in Islamic contexts. Here, they are often said to be the work of Byzantine artists. An excellent case in point is the great Umayyad Mosque in Damascus, which was constructed and decorated with mosaics at the beginning of the 8th century. And Islamic textual sources claim that the material as well as the artists came from the Byzantine Empire. Now, I've analyzed almost 1,000 mosaic tessera from the Great Mosque, and I can tell you that these textual sources are not grounded in reality. The majority of the material came from Egypt at the time, and Egypt at the time was part of the Umayyad Caliphate. So these textual sources are fabricated, and they serve a certain purpose to evoke a Christian Roman heritage, and in so doing, to reinforce prestige and supremacy in a way. So the use of mosaics in the Islamic world, certainly in context of mosques, was certainly a deliberate and politicized choice. Yes, no question about that. So it's a question of what does it actually mean rather than innovations. That said, about a century and a half later, in the 9th century, we have interesting changes in the architectural aesthetics of in the Islamic world. So here we suddenly have a change away from mosaics and more towards the use of glass tiles, even entire floors that were covered in glass tiles. And Samarra in Iraq is a very good example where they invented new decorations made from glass.
Interesting. The other question I had in my mind, going back to what you said right relatively near the start of our interview, you mentioned that these great big blocks were created and then broken down for transportation and for sale. So just maybe this is a stupid question. So an artisan would receive chips, basically, and what, remelt it and then rework it?
Exactly. This is a very important point, actually, something I should stress. We have to separate primary production and secondary production. So the primary production was on this very large scale, and then it was broken up into chunks, so 1, 2, 3 kilos or something like that. And these arrived in secondary workshops where the glass was remelted, colored, and shaped into artifacts. And the other thing that's interesting, secondary workshops we can find everywhere. So primary production is concentrated, secondary working is sort of egalitarian, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I don't know why I never thought of that. I had in my mind that the two were sort of done in the same place. Fascinating.
This is true for later periods. So we are really talking about first millennium.
Uh-huh.
Things change at the turn of the second millennium, and where we start having regional primary production.
Yes, I see. Does anyone have any questions for Nadine on this fascinating material? Yeah, Maria.
Actually, I'm really happy that maybe it will be not question but comment that Nadine talked about this 9th century aesthetic changes, because we can see exactly the same phenomenon in clothing.
That's very interesting. So there are close parallels between the two media. Maria, Montext considers Egyptian society through its economy and material culture, using the monastic environment as an example. Why did you select this period and location as the focus of your study?
I consider the period from the 4th to 8th century very important for Egyptian social, economic, and politic history. We can see all kinds of changes, starting with final division of Roman Empire, their Persian occupation, and at the end, Arab conquest. And all this phenomena you can observe also in the economic life, but also in the development of some techniques and organization of work. I have chosen monastic movement as example, because the daily life of monks are very close to the daily life of the lay population, and we have many sources that can provide us information about this. That means the half of excavated sites in Egypt from this period is has monastic character, and concerning written sources, almost a quarter of the papyri and ostraca, written in Greek and Coptic, came also from this milieu. What we know about monks is really useful to study economic life and production in Byzantine and early Arab Egypt.
And were there two particular types of monastic activity, of ways of living, monastic cultures at that period?
The monastic life was organized in various ways. The monks could live completely alone as hermits, or many hermits were organized in the semi-anachoretic communities.
And what does semi-anachoretic mean?
That means is they still living like hermits. That means in the separate places, but some tasks, some especially religion life and part of economic life were organized for all community. And what is also interesting that monks could also live together if the well-organized monasteries. And we know that there was the division between the men and women communities, but sometimes we have also mixed sex communities, what we call congregation.
Right, I see. So that's the structure of the communities that you were considering for the purposes of your research. Do we know much about this period's textile production? And what new information has been revealed by your work?
And it is very interesting to see that different kinds of community organize in different way the production of textiles. What do we know? That if it was mixed sex communities, it's usually the women spinning and provide the threads for the linen tunics for the men. But men wove their own linen tunics, but not woolen.
Oh, how interesting.
All wool production was concentrated in the women monasteries. They send the products to the men. And it's also very interesting if we are talking about organization, how they send it. If it was the short distance, it was on donkey or dromedary. But for the long distance, they used ships. They constructed special ships to track the products from the women monasteries to the men monasteries from the same congregation.
And so it wasn't a question that the men didn't have the skill. It was simply that men didn't choose to weave wool, or it wasn't appropriate. And so they had to face the logistical problems of transportation rather than the men just weaving the wool. Or was it that they didn't know how? Or?
It is a gender question. In this kind of communities, everything was organized as in the lay population. That means usually the girls learn at home already from the young age spinning and basic weaving. So when they became a nuns, they have already all capacity to do this job. Concerning the men, we have no information about involving of the men in the domestic production, but we know about the professional weavers who were the men or women. And in this case, it was the high qualified weavers working, producing the usually specialized or mass production clothing. Men and women, they respect, if I can say, the common habit in the society. But in the only men communities, we find also the spindles and other proofs that the men could spin also.
So they would rather have to transport the materials that they were producing long distances by boat than simply have the men create their own textiles. That's very interesting as a statement on the culture. The monastic societies sought to reflect so accurately the lay societies around them that they would go through that logistic inconvenience. Can I ask you, you mentioned spindles, what other technologies did you find that they used?
We have also some trace of the weaving on the monastic sites. And what is interesting that in one region of Egypt is the Tep Mountains. In the monastic context, we find many pits and they are interpreted as loom pits.
And how would that work, Maria? What would a loom pit be? You put a loom in a hole? How does that work?
You put a special loom in the hole. And in this case, they use also a roof to fix the beams of the loom.
Okay. So it was suspended?
Yeah.
Okay, I see.
Probably this loom pit connected to the kind of mass production for the monks, but also for the lay population on this region for all this necessary products to funerary.
Aha, that's very interesting. Thank you. My other guests, tell me, do you have any questions that you would like to ask, Maria? So yes, Nadine, what would you like to ask?
I find this gender dimension highly interesting. And one of my questions would be whether you know, and this might be not a fair question, but whether there is, whether you know anything about the monastic lives in other parts of the Byzantine Empire or the Western world as well.
That's mean we have no the same kind of sources. And is one point, and another point is that Egyptian church has been separate from the Byzantine church in the 5th century and follow another way of development. And if you compare the way of life of the monks in Egypt with those from Syria or Asia Minor, it's not the same.
Sasha, Solmes addressed the social features of the medieval Western Balkans funerary phenomenon erected over 500 years ago. They're locally known as steci.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about these stones and why they interest you? I'm particularly fascinated by what they highlight about the multicultural society of that period, because this is really what we're considering here, the interplay between cultures.
So, we are talking about a bit later period, late medieval, so 12th to 16th centuries. And these are the tombstones erected in a society that included at least three religious denominations, five ethnicities, and a dynamic and a diverse system of governments. And as such, steci have an immense potential to reveal societal features of the medieval communities that erected them, because we don't know much about them. And although the region is inherently known as a place of obstinate and incompatible ethnic and religious identities, I believe actually opposite. I believe that steci were not a dividing, but a unifying element in that world.
And what do the stones tell you? I mean, I can see why you'd be interested in them, because they're used by all the cultures. Were people buried together in from different religions? Were they buried in the same areas? And how did that change?
So the religions we are talking about is the Orthodox Christianity, Roman Catholicism, and then we have a locally developed Bosnian church, which was proclaimed heretic in the 13th century. And then later, in the 15th century, we also have Islam. So the burials of those three Christian communities might be in the same place, but we are not sure. So wherever we have churches, there are either Roman Catholic or Orthodox churches, and we assume that people buried there were of the same religion, but we also have many places where we don't have any kind of, let's say, religious element telling us about the specific denomination.
I see.
So still a lot of questions there, not a lot of questions.
And it's fascinating. So it's basically like opening a new book and having the first chapter and seeing all the other chapters to come that you haven't read yet.
Exactly. And we're talking about Europe in the 21st century. It's fascinating, and we don't have to go to, to the moon, to the universe. We have so many unanswered questions here.
Yeah, right in front of us. And tell me, so what were you actually doing with regards to the stones? You were trying to look at the inscriptions. I guess they were very badly weathered. How did you go about that?
Not a lot of people know that there are over 72,000 of steci, so of these tombstones, scattered in the landscape of Western Balkan countries, but predominantly in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Some of them are decorated, and let's say a tiny percentage, a little over 0.5%, also have inscriptions, engraved inscriptions. And these also convey the social plurality. So although the language is local, the epitaphs are written in two scripts, either in Glagolithic or in Bosnian Cyrillic, which were both established in the 9th century, and both are today extinct. So in this digital age today, we used, of course, digital approach to record these inscriptions. We initially used RTI.
And what is RTI?
A reflectance transformation imaging.
How does that work?
You just take a lot of photographs under various angles from different position and with different light exposures. And then using specific software, we were able to clearly see what was written on these tombstones. However, as they are still lying in scattered in the landscape, exposed to all weather conditions and natural processes, and have been for about 600 to 800 years already, these inscriptions became thoroughly eroded, often to the level of being illegible. So the RTI didn't work on such tombstones. So fortunately, modern technology offers solutions for such problems. And in collaboration with Škocjanske Jame Park from Slovenia, we used a handheld 3D scanner. It was a pilot test gate, and we scanned 8 tombstones.
And how did that come out?
So we scanned 8 tombstones, 4 with slightly visible engravings and 4 only with decorations. And then again, specific software and various visualizations showed us what an effective method this is. We found that actually 6 of those 8 staged have inscriptions, and the other 2 had more decorations than which was visible to us, even with RTI. So having such a great result, we are now in process of applying for funding to buy such scanner so that we could use it on every stečak, on every tombstone that we will come across in our future work.
I think it must be very compulsive. I think it must be one of those things where you do one and you've had a full day and you're absolutely exhausted and you keep thinking to yourself, one more, just that one over
exactly.
There. You know, it must be very hard to stop.
Exactly. And also, you know, we are excavating usually in summer. Nice weather, hot, but this handheld scanner doesn't work in very lit environment. So what we did, we woke up at 4 o'clock so that we could be at the site at dawn. And then some people went home, let's say at 3 o'clock, and they came back to the site at 8 o'clock so that we could use the natural elements to get as much as possible from those scans.
That's excellent. And it sounds like it's going to be something that could be used by many other researchers for completely different reasons.
Yeah.
Super. Your work was interrupted by the pandemic, Sasha.
Yeah.
So how are you hoping to build on what you've achieved so far? And what are you actually hoping to discover? What is all this going to actually tell you?
So the pandemic stopped us halfway through our research, but we were fortunate enough to have at least half of our planned work executed. So we adapted to the situation. We changed the order of our work, the workflow. So we did most of our analysis in this, quiet time, a year and a half. The human remains were studied in details, all the molecular analysis, the archaeobotany, the archaeology performed, and so now. So now, I'm pleased to say we also secured the funding to continue where we were stopped in March 2020, and also to expand our research to answer some other questions which actually arose while we were doing the first, the first year of our research.
And may I ask you what one such question might be?
So, for example, where are the settlements that these people buried on the city lived?
Yes, that's interesting. If you've got a whole load of tombstones, where did they come from?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where did they? So usually you have houses or settlements, but you don't have burial places. And here it's the reverse. We have many. We have over 3,000 of sites of burial places, but we don't know where people lived. So, for example, this is just a basic one.
Yeah, how interesting. Yes, that is a very obvious question. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And that's my question to you. Let's see if the other guests have any questions for you. Yes, Maria.
I would like to ask you what we know exactly about the kind of burial. That means there are some clothes or any equipment in this tombs.
So the whole burial is made from underground structure and, of course, these big stones on top. So these are big, large stones, larger than a human form, heavy. Let's say the average weight is about 3 tons, but we also have stones that went up to 25 tons. And so these burials are all skeletal burials. People were buried either in shroud. There were some elements of wooden coffins found, or because, let's say, larger part of this, of the geographical region is karst, so there was a lot of stone available. So they were kind of built tombs inside. So you have, I don't know, let's say a wall with 2-3 levels without any mortar inside. And then we also have natural stone that comes out in thin slices, which were either used as the sides or maybe just a cover of the, let's say, the coffin area, which was then, you know, had a pile of soil on top. And then on top of that was this big tombstone. Some basic questions that, for example, within archaeology, within Europe, we actually don't need to ask anymore because they have been answered, here are still open. So that's, I think, a fascinating thing about this heritage being so understudied and so close to, you know, to the heart of Europe, let's say.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm really glad that you managed to secure that extra funding and you'll be digging even deeper, if I may use, use a pun.
Yes.
That one was accidental. The shine of light at the beginning was deliberate. That one was accidental. Well, listen, thank you very, very much, all of you, for a very interesting conversation. I think that it's I think, particularly fascinating to take three such basic materials of everyday life and look at how they were used and what that can show us about the society's concerns. So I want to thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Abigail, and thank you to my colleagues as well. It was fascinating to hear your stories, narratives.
It was indeed.
I hope that we can continue after our mission.
Oh, perfect.
If you're interested in what other EU-funded projects are doing in the field of archaeology and anthropology, the Cordis website will give you an insight into the results of projects such as these, funded by the Horizon 2020 programme. Articles and interviews explore the results of research being conducted in a very broad range of domains, so whether you're into photonics or phytoplankton, there's something there for you. Maybe you're involved in a project or would like to apply for funding. Take a look at what others are doing in your domain. So come and check out the research that's revealing what makes our world tick. We're always happy to hear from you. Drop us a line, editorial@cordis.europa.eu. Until next time.